Thanks for downloading this podcast from The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry, and if you're ready, we'll begin. The territorial growth of ISIS in Iraq can be measured. In square miles every day, it's measured in the headlines as the Iraqi government forces battle over Tikrit or some other city or an oil facility or the area around Mosul, the suburbs of Baghdad. The territorial disputes and warfare in Iraq are a direct result of something that we can no longer accurately measure. The toll of the three-year-old civil war in Syria is essentially unmeasurable. Even the United Nations has stopped updating its Syria death toll numbers due to how difficult it is to verify facts on the ground in the country. The independent and, dare we say, heroic Syrian Observatory for Human Rights estimates that now the total death toll has reached more than 162,000. Secretary of State John Kerry announced last month that the U.S. will provide an additional $290 million in humanitarian assistance, pushing the total assistance from the U.S. to more than $2 billion. It's probably not going to end the war, though. USAID estimates that more than 9 million people are in dire need of humanitarian assistance in Syria. One of those is a refugee from a Syrian village who sat down in our studio here in New York to tell us about the homeland that for him is changed forever. Amin Ahmed is not his real name, but he's worried that using his real name will put his parents, who are still in the country, at risk. He's a former hospital administrator in Aleppo. He's seen the carnage firsthand and saw the growth of ISIS long before the State Department or the CIA was talking about it.
For Syrians, ISIS is an old story. It's becoming major in the news in the United States because Iraq and the involvement of the United States in Iraq, it's very close to home in the United States. But for us Syrians, we have seen ISIS for a year now, and we know what they'll do. And actually, a lot of my friends were tortured by ISIS because they didn't have the same beliefs as ISIS. ISIS actually hates everyone that doesn't act like they want their version of Islam. So they'll attack Sunnis, Shiites, Alawites, Christians, no matter who they are.
And speaking of the Sunni and the Shia, will there be peace?
Well, there have been peace before. It's just something for power. It's really, there is no such a difference that Shias and Sunni really hate each other, that they will kill each other. It's just political players taking advantage of some ancient animosity to rule. I think that's the main issue. It's power. They want to have power, and they're using whatever means they could. Like all dictators, you know, dictators like the Syrian regime will use any tool in its pocket to rule, continue to have used Al-Qaeda to attack American forces in Iraq back in 2004 and 2009. It will use Hamas, it will use Hezbollah, it will use any means. It will use liberal, Christians, whatever it has to do to stay in power. It's all about power. You know, it's not only about religion. You know, some people really believe in a religion, but these dictators only want power, and that's it. And the only way to stop them is to convince them that they will lose power if they continue on this path.
If the U.S. supplies arms to the opposition, do they invariably strengthen ISIS?
Oh, no way. You know, you have to understand in Syria, if you're talking about Syria, ISIS is so disliked. There is no way, you know, there will be any cooperation with ISIS. ISIS is seen as the enemy, will continue to be the enemy. And regardless the United States gives arms or not, they will fight ISIS because they've been fighting ISIS for 6 months now, and they will continue to fight ISIS. It's a big danger for Syrians. We don't believe in their way of interpreting Islam, and people on the ground can't tolerate them.
And looking at streets and street corners that you know so well.
Well, I had a friend who came out for a week out of Aleppo, and he was calling me after a week. He said, I couldn't find my way back. And actually, this is what is driving a lot of these refugees out of their homes, because they don't feel safe to stay in their homes. And this is having the effect and the burden on all of these countries, because these continuous bombing campaign on civilian areas is driving people out. No one wants to be a refugee. Being a refugee is very humiliating, you know. People feel humiliated. They don't want to They want to work. They want to do it. They want to support their family themselves. They don't want handouts. But when you're faced with, when you have a family and children, you're faced with one choice, being here and killed, and you're, or seeing your children killed, or living and saving them. You always try to save your children and get out of this danger. It's not because of you, it's because of them. And that's why people are going. And if you look at the map, most of the people are staying in areas along the borders with Syria. Most of the Syrians wants to go back to their homes, but with these bombings, they just can't go.
Can you imagine where your son will live?
Well, probably it will be up to my son where he wants to live.
Where do you think he will live? Where do you think your first grandchild will be born?
Well,
What kind of passport will he have?
I don't know. You know, we faced so dangerous situation these past 3 years that we always think that we're not going to make it in the next 10 years. So we never know what's going to happen or the next year. So I really didn't. You surprised me at this question. I really don't know. I really didn't think about it. But of course, I would love him to be in Syria. I would love him to be with his family. And he loves Syria, by the way. He loves Syria very much. And he always asks me, why can't we go there? And it's hard to explain to him why.
Well, it's sad that you don't know the answer. But it's probably a good thing that you're not thinking a lot about it.
Yeah, probably this is the way to, when you work in this type of atmosphere and this type of field, you know, you're always concentrating on your work and how you're trying to help people along the way. It's really very hard, you know. You see tragedies each and every day, from small children who are being killed and people who were tortured or lost their loved ones. It's, you know, the tragedy is all around you. And I don't know, it's probably a habit of mine. The other day I was on Times Square here and a lady fell and I ran away right away to pick her up. It's probably, this is the way I think. I try to help people and this is the way I do it. Regardless, is it Syrian? Is it an American? Is it an Israeli? Is it an Iraqi? Turk? It doesn't matter. It's a human being at the end of the day who needs help and we should help.
Amin, thank you so much. And can you explain why you don't want to use your real name?
Well, the reason I'm traveling around, you know, I'm coming on shows and going on meetings and seminars is because I want to tell my story of transformation during this tragedy that happened in Syria. Is that being grown up in Syria and raised in Syria, we had a lot of hate and animosity against Israel, of course. And they always teach you that the Israelis, financed by the Americans and this Zionist organization all over the world, are trying to destroy your country. They want to take our homes. And they want to kill us and drive us and destroy us. So we should, if we have the opportunity, we should do the same for against them. And then the revolution happened in Syria, and we had to, you know, I act and I saw the brutality that was happening from my own president, my own army, the army that we financed with our tax dollars, let's say, bombing us and killing us and shooting at us, and the dangers that we were facing, and then being driven out of my country because of the threat, because I was treating people, that if I continue to treat people, of course, I will go to prison, probably be tortured and killed. And when I went over, the surprise to me was that some NGOs came up to us and offered help. And to our surprise, the NGOs were Israeli NGOs. So it was a pretty shock, big shock for us. Because we were like, why do you want to help us? Aren't you happy that we're killing each other? We have the feeling that, you know, after 6 or 1 year of, we felt like the world abandoned us, that no one cared about us, that everyone was happy. You know, Muslims are killing each other, let them kill each other, let them butcher each other. We had this feeling of everyone abandoning us, that we were left alone to fend for ourselves. And to see your enemy, the arch enemy that you hate and you, if you saw him, probably you would fight him and kill him. And coming to your aid and offering hand to help you, this was amazing. You know, at the beginning, we were very suspicious. And a lot of aid came in, a lot of people got treated, a lot of people were transferred to Israel. And this was really a thing that changed my mind, my perspective. Now, you know, out of this big tragedy, we see people as humans. We don't see each other as Jews and Muslims or Christians and Muslims or Israelis and Syrian. We just see each other as human beings are trying to help each other. I know it's very hard. I know the Middle East is, you know, you always hear the news every day. Every day, another tragedy coming out of it. But it's this stuff, it's this action in this desperate times, I think, that makes the difference. You have to act during this desperate means. This is the time when you can change the minds and hearts of people. It's not when they are living in their house and doing nothing and thing. It's when they are desperate and when they are leaving their home and you come to aid them. That's when you make your mark.
Well, a positive, hopeful sign in something where it's very difficult to find any sort of hope. Amin, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
We now want to welcome to the program the Superintendent of Financial Services for New York State, Regulator Benjamin Losky. The largest bank in France, BNP Paribas, has now agreed to an $8.9 billion penalty, essentially pleading guilty for doing business with countries like Sudan and Iran, nations blacklisted by the United States. Mr. Losky is one of the lead architects of the case against BNP Paribas. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
A couple of things. If this $8.9 billion penalty goes through, would that be a record for these kinds of crimes?
I believe it's the largest case in the sanctions area, yes. So we have a whole series of cases that have happened over the last 10 years related to sanctions violations by certain banks, and this would be the largest.
So there would be larger penalties that might have to do with tax sheltering, but in terms of violating international sanctions, this is definitely right at the top.
Yes, no question. There have been larger penalties, for example, in the mortgage area, but for sanctions cases, this is right at the top.
And what would you say in terms of the strategy here? Is this taking a hardline approach against Paribas? Is this a different prosecutorial strategy?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, day after the Monday morning quarterbacking we're seeing now, some people are saying it's still not enough punishment. Other people are saying it's too harsh. So I think that when you get criticism from both sides, it might mean that you're starting to get it about right, a little bit like the Three Bears. I think that the focus has to be on, are we adequately deterring future bad conduct? What we want ultimately when we step back from these cases is a safer, a better, a fairer financial system and banking system. And when banks and the people that work at banks start to realize that if they take certain conduct that is inappropriate, illegal, et cetera, that there are going to be real substantial consequences and the kinds of consequences that cause people to change their behavior, I think that's when we start moving towards a better system. Are we there yet? I don't think so, but I think that's where we're trying to move.
Although you mentioned deterrence, that plays right into the issue that's been discussed in the financial press, on TV, and the FT and the Wall Street Journal. When you talk about deterrence, you also talk about making an example of a particular institution. So if you're harsher on them, the deterrence that you get coming down the line means that maybe you are jiggling the penalty a little bit to get the deterrence effect and not being across the board fair in a strictly judicial sense. How do you resolve that?
Yeah, it's hard, and I think you have to find a balance whenever you're looking at what types of penalties to impose. And I think when you have a case and then another case and another case, but you continue to see the bad conduct happening in many banks, I think it can cause a regulator or a prosecutor to say, maybe we're not getting this right, and we're not taking the kinds of actions, whether it's actions that are the penalties are serious enough or large enough, or whether they're the right type of penalties. And I'll tell you what I mean by that. You can often penalize a bank with a huge dollar figure that they have to pay. But for a bank, that's often just something that can be a cost of doing business, and they can pass it on to their shareholders.
License. And it's not like in this case any, you know, Sudanese villager is going to benefit from these particular penalties, right?
Right. And I think what we need to do is step back, and when we look at these cases and we look at all the banking misconduct cases we have around the system, when you step back, a bank, a corporation is a legal fiction. It's just a group of people. And a bank itself doesn't commit misconduct. It's not a sentient being. People in the bank commit misconduct. And I think we need to step back and say, how do we cause people inside those banks to change their conduct? You know, banks don't commit misconduct. Bankers do. And I think there, just a huge dollar penalty may at some point not have all that much impact. I think it's an important component of finding the right mix of penalties. But we also need to have real consequences for the people, the individuals who engage in the bad conduct. In this case, there were about we pushed very hard at our agency for the bank to hold people accountable. Many of them are overseas, so we don't have jurisdiction. But in our negotiations, we did basically tell the bank that there was a whole group of people that had to be terminated and had their reputations really sullied. And that's hard to do. You have to be sure that you have the facts because you are talking about affecting an individual's career. But here, the COO was ousted. A couple other chief compliance people were also ousted. We named them in our press release, so we weren't shy about that. And again, you don't love doing that, but I think as we try to get this mix right and we want to send the message out to the world that if you commit this misconduct as an individual, it's going to impact you, your career, your livelihood, how much money you make, et cetera, I think that can really have an additional impact. It may even have more impact than some enormous fine.
All right, I'm going to give you the rest of the time here in this segment, but because you said that, I want to sort of push this out a little bit. I mean, let's talk about the 2009. And this isn't necessarily your expertise, and this is, you know, a sensitive area for you personally. But as a regulator, since I have you right here in the studio, mm-hmm. you know, a bank is a bunch of people that do things. You know, that's what you just said. If that is the case, how come no bankers went to jail for what happened in 2009? Because a lot of Americans sitting out there listening to you say that go, well, hey, wait a minute. We're hearing every day that money equals speech in, you know, Citizens United, that corporations are people, you know, in the presidential campaign, but yet nobody actually is behind bars from something like the financial meltdown. I know you politically have different views than other people in the SEC, but what do you think about that?
Yeah, well, let me step back first and say, you know, whatever I do think about it, where I work at the Department of Financial Services, we're a regulator. We actually don't have grand jury or indictment authority, so there's sort of nothing we can do about it.
You're not.
But stepping back from it more broadly, personally, I think it is I get it. It's very frustrating. It's hard to understand how it is that we got in this situation. And I think part of it is a question of resources. I think if you devote enough prosecutorial resources, and I am a former prosecutor in another life. If you devote enough prosecutorial resources, let's say like they did in Enron, after the Enron meltdown, there was a huge Enron task force created. Hundreds of FBI agents, prosecutors from all of the country, over the country, brought down the best and the brightest of the prosecutors, brought down to Texas to really focus on what happened at Enron. And they brought a whole series of serious criminal cases. We did not do that after the financial crisis in the same way.
And that's the lesson.
It's a big question out there.
Benjamin Losky, Superintendent of Financial Services for the State of New York. Thanks so much for your candor.
Thank you for having me.
We are about to take a look at two of the faces in the high school graduating class of 2014. The more than 3 million people getting their diplomas this year represent an increase in graduates, but the stresses in the educational system and the resource questions associated with all these new grads do not have much to do with birth rates. If all we did was count the birth rate in the United States, we'd be seeing plateaus or declines in everything from school enrollment to the number of soccer fans. That's right. America is dealing with an influx of population, not your standard issue rise in population by birth rate. And remember, the USA has the third largest population in the world after China and India. So this is a big driver of soccer fandom, the global economy, and especially U.S. politics. Joining us to talk about all of this is Dante Chinney, the director of the American Communities Project at American University. Welcome, Dante.
Well, thank you for having me on.
So we're really experiencing a peak of, you know, a demographic shift that relates really to influx numbers, not so much birth rate numbers. Tell me about it.
Well, that's right. I mean, what we really have is we have an all-time high right now for the foreign-born population in the United States, and it's up quite a bit even from back in 2000. It was about 31 million foreign-born. Now there's about 40 million foreign-born in the United States, and some of that is going to be this bump you're talking about at the lower end of the demographic spectrum right now, the under 25.
So how is this distributed, and what likely impacts are we going to see politically? You know, we'll talk about the education stuff in a moment, but, you know, it's got to shake up the system in a lot of different ways.
Well, yeah, the distribution is what's really interesting. When you look at where the foreign-born are, you know, this is a record number, but it's really clumped in big cities and metropolitan areas. So you talk about in the American Communities Project, these biggest, the counties that hold the biggest cities in America, 23% of the population in those places is foreign-born. And some of the spikes are crazy. You look at Queens County in New York up there, 47% of the population is foreign-born. So this looks like a massive driver and a big wave coming through the system in a lot of different ways. But then really, once you get out of those big city areas, it drops off, and it drops off pretty precipitously. You get into some of the smaller areas in America, rural areas, aging farmlands, we call them, rural middle America, working class country, evangelical communities in the South. These places are all below 3% in their foreign-born population. So what you really see is kind of a staggering divide in terms of how this issue, this issue really of immigration, is perceived in the United States.
Would you say that areas that are associated with an influx in foreign-born are also associated with economic growth or political change in some way?
Yeah, that's an excellent way. Particularly, you're talking about economic growth. The metropolitan centers are increasingly the economic drivers of the United States, and that's where this big kind of push in foreign-born population is. Politically, what's happened is, look, what's happening in this country, anybody who's been following the immigration fight understands that Democrats have really been pushing for immigration reform and want some kind of path to citizenship for illegal immigrants who are already here. And a lot of these foreign-born are foreign-born, but they are not yet U.S. citizens. They're not naturalized citizens yet. In these big cities, about 45% of them, only 45% are U.S. citizens. The rest are not. So what you have is really a push that the Democrats have really kind of been able to bump along on now toward more drawing these foreign-born populations to vote Democratic, pushing these places even more Democratic. This is particularly true not just at the big cities, but with the suburbs around them, the urban suburbs, we call them, in the American Communities Project. About 17% of the population in those places is foreign-born. And again, that's compared to a national figure of about 12.9, so quite a bit higher.
Now, I used to live in suburban Washington, and Loudoun County in Virginia was associated with horsey country, and that was about as conservative as a place that you could find in America, no longer, right?
It's remarkable. Loudoun County, since in 2000, about 11% of the population in Loudoun was foreign-born, which was, you know, I guess kind of high. It surprised me that it was that high, because you're right, very conservative. It is the gateway to horsey country out there. But it has gone from 11% in 14 years, has gone from 11% to 22% foreign-born.
Wow.
Loudoun County is just a completely changed place. And as that's happened, Loudoun County has fallen pretty neatly now, pretty safely into the Democratic column come presidential elections or last November here in the gubernatorial race.
And it used to be that Oakland County near Detroit was a comfortable sort of white and relatively conservative bedroom community to Detroit, no longer.
That's right. In fact, it used to be there were the three counties around Detroit, Wayne, the center where Detroit is, always Democratic, Macomb County, which kind of split, which was kind of on the fence, and then Oakland, which was Republican. What's happened now is Detroit, Wayne County is still very Democratic. Wayne still kind of sits on the fence, but Oakland County, which has seen a big growth in foreign-born population, is now fairly reliably Democratic. In fact, more reliably Democratic than Macomb, than the county that sits right next to it.
Any interesting cases in Texas?
Yeah, Texas gets very interesting. What you have down there is these Hispanic centers are the other places where you have big foreign-born populations. 20% of them is foreign-born. But in those places, you don't really see a lot of Democrats, a lot of Democratic movement in the vote. Because what happens is you get down to some of these counties in Texas, and you're talking about places where you have such a large conservative white population that you just really can't, you really can't do anything. So you look at some of the counties down there, Sutton, places where you've got a big foreign-born population, went heavily for Mitt Romney. The foreign-born population isn't enough to swing what's going on there. In fact, what I think is happening in those places, it would require a lot more study, is the foreign-born population is pushing the native-born Anglo population, the white population, to be even more conservative, more Republican. And it's
because
really
it focuses on those border security issues. They raise those security issues when they see the influx, and that pushes the vote turnout.
That's absolutely true. And then the other thing to keep in mind is just the raw politics of it, which is these immigrant populations, these foreign-born populations moving in are very Democratic. The population that's already there is very Republican. And I think, if anything, that forces both sides to get their backs up a bit, particularly the U.S. citizens down there. The white native-born population really wants to draw the line and make sure their place stays the way they think it should be in their mind, which is as Republican as it is right now.
And you've got a time lag situation depending on how people get actual citizenship and become voters, as opposed to just people who have crossed the border. All right, what about Middle America before we go?
Middle America that's where you talk about, particularly you get to the upper Great Lakes, really upper New York State. You're talking about places where the foreign-born population is 1-3%, extremely low. So when you're trying to get something like immigration reform done in Congress, they simply don't see the need to do it. They don't see an issue because they don't really see a lot of foreign-born population around them.
Dante Cheney is director of the American Communities Project. He spoke with us from Washington, D.C. Thanks so much, Dante.
Thanks, John.
The milestone of high school graduation is a bit of the mechanized churn of one of the largest educational systems on the planet. The expectation is that 3,219,000 students will graduate in the U.S. this year when the final numbers are tallied. Not an all-time high, but still among the largest graduating classes ever in America. Danielle Motinda-Becca needed some real one-on-one guidance to make it to graduation. Danielle is a 19-year-old reporter with WNYC's Radio Rookies program who didn't speak English when she came to the U.S. at age 13 from the Congo. By her senior year, though, her language skills and general academic performance gave her an 85 average, but she had failed the state regent exam for U.S. history 3 times. She had one more chance. WNYC education reporter Yasmin Khan followed Danielle and another high school student, Paula, during the last month of high school. Her reporting says much about the dropout crisis in America due to not being able to give students the one-on-one attention to make it those last few steps to the finish line. Yasmin says Danielle Motinda-Becca's story is not that unusual.
I think Danielle's story is pretty emblematic of a lot of issues that especially English language learners, students who come here from a foreign country, that they face in trying to complete requirements for graduation from high school. Nationally, first of all, there's a high school dropout rate of about 7%, and it's a little bit higher in New York. We're looking at 11% here in the city. Those numbers are higher for students, Black and Latino students, and for English language learners, they're much higher. But there are lots of reasons why we're losing students in high school. It could be because they face very specific hurdles. Or they're not engaged in school at all.
Now, what is unique about the challenges in New York and the specific challenges facing Danielle?
Well, in New York State, you have to earn a certain number of credits to graduate high school, just like you would anywhere.
Right.
And you have to pass 5 state exams. So U.S. history, global history, science, that kind of thing, math, and English. So in New York State, those specific exams can trip up students. In Danielle's case, it was the U.S. History Regent exam because she didn't have that background growing up.
How were the regents presented to you? How terrifying were they? How big of a sort of looming, monster out there were they stalking you?
First, my freshman year, one of my counselors said, "We have an exam." So I thought it was like, you take a regular exam, then you find the result, then it's over. But no, it was Regents. And he said, "You need 4 more to go." I'm like, "What?" And he said, "Regents." I'm like, "What is Regents?"
This became a really big deal. And you started with very little information, but very quickly you realized this was a pretty stressful situation. How do high school administrators and personnel, how do they perceive and observe the stress on the part of students?
I mean, it totally varies, I think, in terms of how, I mean, Danielle went to a school, Washington Irving High School, where maybe school staff could have helped to guide you a little bit more, it sounded like, to get through this process. They can be kind of a monster in a way, I think, because you are allowed to take them multiple times too. But if you are a student who maybe is not good at taking tests, or you don't feel successful in high school in general, and that may be why you're not engaged, these tests just become a real burden.
And the principals understand this as well. Here's Gloria Rosario, who's the principal of West Brooklyn Community High School, which is one of the schools that you focused on here.
There's a lot of stress internally, printing out the diplomas. Sometimes we'll print out a diploma thinking this is set. The student fails the Regents, we shred it, which is just, you know, heartbreaking. I think I always have to be careful of, like, how much emotional investment we're putting in one kid, and it scares me, I think.
And Gloria also, Gloria Rosario there, is speaking to a couple of points. One, the fact that it is a big hurdle a lot of times for students to get past these very specific tests. You have to show what you know on one day at one time. And also the fact that students who maybe have fallen behind in high school really need every last second to count up until the end. And Regents exams are given twice a year, but when they're given in June, it's right before graduation. So they have to print official diplomas for students who are on track to graduate. But if those students don't pass the Regents, they can't walk. And the school has to shred the diplomas.
That is so heartbreaking. Of course, it's Gloria's job as principal to follow the students, but it became your job to follow a particular student, Paula, at that school.
That's right.
How much were you watching the scorecard right up to the end?
Oh, we were all watching the scorecard, basically. Her counselor, her teacher, the principal, Gloria. And Paula passed. She graduated. But she just passed kind of by the skin of her teeth. It was the opposite situation of Danielle's. Paula was not fully engaged in high school. She was still kind of hanging on to these bad habits of not showing up to class. She just couldn't get herself to school, even though she's very bright. So she was failing a class.
I was in high school. Now what? You know, it was like stepping into the real world. What am I going to do? You know, the questions like, who am I going to become? What am I going to do with my life? Am I going to be successful?
So, Danielle, those are now your questions. You know all about the Civil War, and you passed your U.S. History Region exam finally, right? How many times did you take it?
This was the fourth time.
Fourth time. Good for you. And I'm not going to quiz you about the Civil War or the War of 1812. I'll quiz Yasmin.
Danielle knows more than I do, I know.
Yeah, I need to
take this exam, too.
But do you ask those same questions now? All right, I made it out of high school. I think that it's an ending, but actually it's really a beginning, right?
Yeah, of course. It's not the end. It's just another step towards, you know, a new beginning. So I'm happy to begin that journey very soon, so yay.
Yay, indeed. What are your plans, any?
My plan is to start to LaGuardia, which I already got accepted next year, 2015, September. And, you know, do 2 years communication, then move on to the next level.
LaGuardia Community College in Queens, right?
Yes.
Yep. So is the Regents program in New York a help in the graduation issue? Is it a hurt? Is there any way to say generalized around the country? Do tests help, hurt? What do we do? What do we know at the end of all this?
People are asking those questions right now. And I think that especially in New York State, they're trying to come up with what they call multiple pathways to graduation, because they recognize that not all students necessarily are bound for college, or if they are, they might already have a sort of specific direction in mind of where they want to go. Maybe vocational types of studies, specific career studies are more suited for them. And we've had these very specific requirements for all students, and it might not be one size fits all.
Mm-hmm. Indeed, that's what we're learning. That's part of this Project American Graduate Public Media Initiative addressing the dropout crisis, supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and reported for us by Yasmin Khan and two graduates, two happy faces, at least in our story. Paula, who you profiled, and Danielle right here in the studio. Danielle Motin-Dabaka, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening. As always, I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.